On FBI, we're listening to the title track from Lawrence English's new album, Wilderness of Mirrors. And we're going to hear a fair bit about the background of this album, and we're going to talk, I think, a bit about everything that's been happening with Lawrence in the last while. I've got him on the line now from Brisbane. Are you there, sir?
I am, Peter. How are you going?
I'm very well. It's been quite a while since we've chatted, particularly in any kind of official capacity. So it's really nice.
Social media doesn't count, does it?
No.
It's communication.
I don't know what it is, but anyway, even if it's slightly public, this is a bit more, and we get to talk about things in a public fashion, which is nice. I'm letting the next bit of this album play in the background, I think we'll start here. I always love when I'm talking to artists to get a bit of sort of history and background and context in, but I think it'd be nice to start where we are now. The main reason for this conversation is the new album. It's been getting some really nice sort of words from people all around the world that I've been reading anyway. I guess a notable fact is that it's the first solo album that you've released on Room 40. So should we start there?
It's a little bit late, really.
In a way, yeah. So
considering next year is 15 years for the label, it does feel like, wow. I thought, oh, yeah, I really should probably get around to doing that.
That's really interesting. There wasn't really any other ulterior motive behind it?
Well, quite honestly, I realised that what I wanted to do with this record was to just be able to do it on my own terms.
Mm.
And as much as I love working with other labels, and I genuinely do love that and have done it for a long time,
yep.
There is a certain flexibility, I guess you could say, that comes with just doing it yourself. And that's pretty much where I've come from, is the whole DIY end of the world.
Mm.
And obviously I've been doing it myself for other people, you know, through the label and that kind of thing. And I thought, well, it's probably about time. And there was an opportunity in the schedule because there's only a few releases this year.
Yeah, right.
I thought, well, it makes sense to kind of give this a go. And to be honest, I've really enjoyed it. I thoroughly have enjoyed the process of doing it completely myself. That's very differently rewarding, maybe.
Yeah, right. There's a few things about releasing your own music, one of which is the whole sort of self-promotion is so much harder than promoting other artists and being passionate about someone else's work, which you can do in a really genuine way, and it can feel totally a bit weird when it's yourself. But I guess Room 40 is John Chantler still involved and as involved as...
No, John had to... because John became the booker for Cafe Otto.
Cafe Otto, yeah.
Like, his entire life kind of disappeared into that wormhole for years.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic, because, I mean, he has done an incredible job of programming that space.
I know.
And to look at what's come through there is just... I mean, for me, it's completely mind-boggling. The guy's a genius, how he manages to pull those monthly programs together.
Mm.
But in terms of the promotion thing, actually, that was something I was... Probably, to be completely frank, is the thing that I'm most conscious of.
Mm.
And I actually haven't done any of my own press. I've got people that have done it for us this time. Simply for the fact I don't really want to be doing that. You're right, it's a kind of conundrum. How it is that you can talk about your work in a genuine way, and hopefully it's these kinds of opportunities where you can kind of, you know, critically talk about the work, but you're not actually sort of out there basically hustling it, which I don't have a lot of interest in doing.
Mm.
I mean, I do for other people's work that I'm completely passionate and in love with, but you just can't do it for your own work. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, exactly. And even if you are good at, you know, writing the words, it's just still, it's that problem of how to come across, how to make it come across, right, I guess. So, certainly, I mean, it has, the press has worked, I feel, for this album, and it's certainly worth it. And so I'd be just interested now in getting you to talk about how it's come to pass, how you differentiate it from the last few releases you've done, which have had all had themes in a way. And one of the themes, well, there's a lot of themes behind this album, but one of the interesting ones is that you've made it in two parts. I guess I'm listening to it on a CD, but one of those, one of the aspects of that might just be the two sides of a record. But what else is there behind that?
Well, look, that was definitely, I wanted to make an LP. In a way that I, what I like about listening to the, you know, the physical format of music, and particularly albums. I mean, it's interesting. I was just having this conversation today with some people in two different scenarios, and what I found really interesting is people talking about the idea of tracks. And it's a great example. You opened with Wilderness of Mirrors, which is, I mean, it is, okay, it's a track, there's a track ID.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like half of a composition.
Sure, exactly.
And that's a, that for me is a, you know, it's a point of tension in a way, which I really like, that it's unclear where these things begin and end and where the bleed is between one and another. And I always enjoyed listening to, there are a few records over the years where there are just these kind of arbitrary track points. I think the most kind of beautifully obnoxious is I forget which Tim Hecker record it is, but one of them is just incredibly obnoxious, you know, like it'll cut halfway through a track.
Yeah,
and I love that. I love the fact that it's like, well, actually, if you want this experience, what you need to do is listen to the album, not listen to the track.
That's what it's always about, isn't it? Like the Farmer's Manual one, which is all, I think, 1 minute tracks the whole way through.
Yeah, which is fantastic.
Yeah,
totally fantastic.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's, it's a different relationship to the idea of time in music, and you know, music is all time. So I can understand that maybe there's not an opportunity to kind of invest in something like that, but I would almost rather, the, you know, personally anyway, I would rather not listen to something in pieces.
Senses, I suppose, two parts, but there are still, yeah, two parts. And are the two sides, do they have a different character to you and a different feeling or meaning in some way?
For me, it was interesting. I sent the record to Brian Ritchie, who's a kind of a friend from Tasmania, and, you know, he was really spot on. He wrote back and said, this is very classical, and it kind of is, you know. There is a sort of very traditional structure to the record, and in terms of the actual character of each of the sides, I see it as a sort of slow reveal. You know, the things that are cloaked on the first half are somehow coming into clarity on the second half, and by the very end of the record you have these, you know, the closest things to melodies and very clear instrumentation that maybe isn't so clear but is still very present on the first half of the record.
That's really interesting. I think after we have a chat, I'm going to play the last part, at least, of the second half of the record, and so we can have a sort of hear of that. And one thing I've noticed when I've read a couple of interviews that you've done, I suppose, is your objection to people assuming that it's sort of synthesized music and electronic music when there's so much real instrumentation in there. So obviously that's quite important to you with this.
Well, I think it's probably just making a point of it this time then, because I've been so interested in it as a process. And a lot of the records do have that as a characterization. I guess maybe previously with something like Kirin or Otto, the point of conversation sat around what is a field recording and what's not a field recording, for example.
Yeah,
so
right.
It was a different kind of cloaking or a different kind of disguise, ambiguity. Whereas for this one, I kind of wanted to very much focus on the potential of how you can make instruments feel alien, feel one step removed, feel like something you haven't actually encountered before.
So which is perhaps a similar thing to what happened with field recordings in some way, but although maybe some of the sort of conversation with field recordings and music was just also about how appropriate or not it is to sort of combine those two art forms as much as how to turn field recordings into music or something. But
Yeah, there's a question, definitely a question of meaning there. And I think that's still the same, actually, in some respects with this record. It's just maybe the meaning falls more on this idea of perspective, whether you're kind of engaging something, you know, orally on a kind of micro or a macro perspective, how it is that your ears come to understand the things that they're in contact with.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting from my experience of the album, because I was, it's a particular experience, but I was overseas when it came out, and I was sent the download, which I then was only able to listen to on tiny little speakers or on my earphones, and so I guess probably what I got was what you're talking about as the macro perspective, and it did sound sort of just, you know, like a drone, a beautiful drone album. And it's only kind of as you progress through it that you sort of start seeing those details. And then you'll go back and you'll listen to the first part and you'll definitely start perceiving a lot of that extra detail in there.
Part of the trick is always that thing of saturation for me. You know, I want to get to that point where you just can't... If you choose to kind of take everything in, it just becomes this wall of noise or wall of sound. And then if you can somehow penetrate into, if you like, bandwidths or activities within that piece, then you can find a detail, you know. So there's this kind of constant giving and taking between the kind of presence of detail and the absence of detail, depending on where it is that you try and position your ear when you're listening to the piece. It's good to be drowned. It's good to be kind of swallowed up by stuff every once in a while, you know.
Sure. So do you think that musically there's more of that sort of drowning and that sort of extreme noise aspect to this album than you've had before as well, sort of large big spectrum sort of stuff, a la obviously Ben Frost and so on?
I think probably I've expressed it differently before. Like, for me, Kirin Otto is still really a, you know, it's big slabs of sound that kind of, you know, concrete slabs that sort of, you know, basically rough up against each other. I think the difference between this one and something like Kirin Otto is that there's a multiplicity of tensions. You know, there's more things that are working for and against each other all the time, so it's not always quite as direct as something like Kirin Otto, which is this very thick, heavy, sludgy thing. Whereas maybe Wilderness, you know, I guess looking at the title of the metaphor, it's much more about this idea of reflection, much more about this idea of feedback, of a lack of clarity, about not knowing exactly where it is or what it is that you're listening to or where that's come from.
Okay, so yeah, mirrors also as sort of distorted reflectors in a way.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I think that was the thing that really got me with the phrase Wilderness of Mirrors was, you know, it is obviously a very visual metaphor, but when you start to think about how that can be translated into a kind of auditory experience, you get a whole lot of, I mean, apart from having the kind of Conan the Destroyer moment where you picture Schwarzenegger at his best, you move on from that. That was the good news. I did move on from the Schwarzenegger into something slightly more, you know, or maybe less muscular. I don't know. It's hard to compete with him during that period.
Yeah.
But, you know, you start to think about all the ways that, you know, in the everyday environment, you know, when we're walking around or anything like that, that's what we're... Reflection is the key thing that gives us the ability to understand where we are, what we're experiencing, how it is that we position ourselves in the world. So I think that, you know, something like this, an album does the same thing at its best for me. You know, you're kind of repositioned in this other field that maybe you're just unfamiliar with, and that uncertainty can be really thrilling, or just completely alienating. And I'm hoping that I fall somewhere in the middle.
maybe more towards the thrilling end, but
I'm happy to alienate a little bit.
Okay, yeah, no, for sure. Okay, I'm talking to Lawrence English, the new album is Wilderness of Mirrors, and. I was really interested in what you were talking about then, because it feels in a way like it draws a bit from maybe what you've learnt from the art of field recordings, which is something that I think around the world you're quite known for among other things, as well as the label and your music and so on. But yeah, because to listen to field recordings requires a certain type of, kind of listening activity from the listener as well as from the artist. And there's certainly, questions of the what the narrative is of the recording and what's put into it by the listener and so on, all of those questions. I'm not sure if you could hear it, but I was playing a track from Kirino Otto in the background.
I recognise that because I love that wave recording at the end of that.
Yes,
track.
Well, that's the thing. It's exactly, and so in a way, because you're using those field recordings, it's a little, well, it makes it kind of explicitly about something, which is perhaps the sort of vastness of the sea and water and that sort of vastness and envelopingness. But yeah, if you make it more abstract, then you can say other things, I suppose, with the music, say or not say.
It's interesting. I think that's definitely right. I mean, once there is a kind of like almost semiotic marker, you know, in something that's one, I guess that gives you some root.
Right.
But what I found really interesting is particularly in concerts is, you know, I have these wind recordings which are actually being published by Tiger in a couple of months from Patagonia and Antarctica. And I've played these wind recordings from Patagonia a lot. One of the first times I ever played them was in Sydney, actually, at the Art Gallery of New South Wales when I did a show with Stephen Battilio.
All right, yep.
And I honestly love these recordings. They're like some of my favourite recordings I've ever made, partly because I really enjoyed making them because they were very, very difficult, like not just technically difficult, but I physically suffered to make them. I thought, this is great. You know, this is what I want out of, yep, you know, my practice.
Yep.
But when I play those, no one hears, even though, it sounds like wind. To me, it sounds like wind, but no one ever really picks. I've had people say, I was once on a boat in the ocean and we had a huge storm and it was like being inside the boat. Someone else told me it was about a time that they were at their grandmother's house and there was a huge, gust of wind and all the windows had shutters and they were shutting open and closed. And, you know, everyone has this particular impression of what it is, because the thing that I love about working with sound in, you know, whether it's on an album, in installation, you know, however it is that you want to kind of come at it, sound is like, it's so invitational, you know, and it asks the listener to fill in the blanks. There's nothing that, I mean, there's a kind of, it's largely non-representational.
Mm.
You know, that's maybe a problematic to some degree.
Yeah.
But, you know, there is this at least reduction of representation.
Yeah.
And it means that people can kind of, if they choose, they can put themselves into that situation and call on all of that, you know, sociocultural, political memory inside them to make it have meaning. That is fantastic, you know. No one can ever have that same experience that other person is having.
That's really interesting. And so I guess what that means is it doesn't matter whether it's the most abstract music or music which kind of has a performative and social meaning to someone. So, you know, you could play a piece of music that has some obvious meaning, like the Stars and Stripes or something that is going to obviously evoke certain things in someone's mind, or it might just be emotional or who knows. But then even when you get to something that's perhaps a lot more specific, like the sound of waves breaking or whatever, there's still an enormous amount that's filled in by the listener. And
it's also like, the thing is, the Stars and Stripes has meaning because we as people of the West recognize it as a kind of anthem. But, you know, I'm sure if you were to play that to some of these new groups that have just come out of the Bolivian Amazon,
wherever
it is that those two new groups have come out from, I'm sure they would be like, wow, you know, that's some stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
That I don't understand at all because I've never heard sound coming out of a speaker before.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, that's right. So it's sort of almost in a way, it doesn't matter, but even when you're sort of reducing the freedom or abstractness of the sound, in a way, most of the same sort of stuff applies in terms of
listening. Degrees of ability to kind of come at something, you know, like I think obviously for someone like you, you're listening to a lot of new music all the time. So you've got a kind of really, you've got a cultural capital to call on. You've got a kind of auditory literacy.
Yeah.
That maybe someone that is, you know, hasn't ever listened to much music doesn't have, you know. Maybe they just like some other thing, or that, you know, they read and whatever it is that they spend their time doing.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, you know, they have a different kind of capacity and potentially a different kind of preparedness to kind of engage with that stuff.
Yeah, and it's interesting when any kind of art form sort of starts to feed back on itself and use that cultural capital in ways to create new art, which can be really exciting, but of course really alienating sometimes to people who don't, who can't draw on that in some way. I'm not sure if that really applies to this sort of music, but yeah, it's sort of something that happens quite often, and whole genres can sort of disappear up their own fundaments in some ways.
Yeah, and very quickly now. That's what I think is interesting about kind of contemporary music. You can have these things that literally self-combust in a matter of months, you know, or years maybe.
Yeah.
Whereas what might have taken, you know, you look at the travelling of something like dub and reggae out of Jamaica into North America. This is the thing that took like a decade and a half.
But then
you look at something like, I don't know, tech life, guys coming out, and suddenly that thing's being represented in a whole bunch of other places around the world, even though it's only potentially socially meaningful to people in Chicago.
And that also speaks to the universality of music, because it does have a lot of meaning and, you know, excitement and energy for people who perhaps have never seen anyone actually dancing in footwork style, and may have never even get up on the dance floor, because It's sort of still all music, and there's sort of still reference points for anyone who wants to listen to it of some sort, I guess.
Yeah, definitely.
I wanted to sort of talk a little bit. I'm not sure exactly how to kind of make this point, but just talk about, I guess, what I was thinking about when we were talking a long time ago, before you probably even started making most of this stuff. And, you know, you were interested, as I was, in a lot of electronica, basically, and sort of, you know, IDM, dance music, I guess industrial and so on. And you made a few albums in the early days that were beat-oriented, I suppose, including the Object Project. I was listening to the first of those albums on Sub Rosa or Quatermass or something, and
definitely.
I suppose it's just interesting thinking how, you know, so many of the people who are working in these kinds of fields now, whether it's John Zeller or Keith Fullerton Whitman and so on, I guess a lot of them started in beats of some sort and then made their way into really issuing that whole kind of thing completely, I suppose, that whole
I mean, I think it's definitely a really interesting phenomenon. I have to say, for me, probably, I don't know whether I eschew it or whether it's I have to be totally honest. Now, I love making work, and I love working with people, and I think that has probably led to, I mean, when you look at the things I've been part of in the last decade, let's say, and I suppose probably more collaboratorial projects,
right?
A lot of it doesn't, I mean, if you try and pull it all together, it doesn't necessarily make sense, I don't think, anyway. But the thing that maybe is the central interest there is people that approach their work with a particular method that maybe I don't understand, but I want to have an engagement with. I mean, working with someone like Tennis Goats, for example, you know, those guys, in some respects, the antithesis of how I work. This is what I love about them so much. You know, like, I am so process-oriented. Like, I'm not the kind of person that you can give a guitar to and then suddenly there's a beautiful song. But you give a guitar to Wenno, there's a beautiful song, and then the next minute there's this incredible abstract thing that would make Derek Bailey get excited. You know, it's just, I don't have that in me. That's not part of who I am. But I'm fascinated by that in them. And the kind of exchanges, because I guess my process is alien to them in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I know. And I think that's what we like to share. And I think a lot of those projects like that, or the Tajiko Noriko trio with John and Noriko, you know, each of those have a particular kind of focus or investment. I mean, right now I'm working on a project with Jamie Stewart.
All right.
I'm completely loving, absolutely loving working on it because, you know, we have different ways of coming at things, but we have this shared, kind of shared musical history in a way. You know, there are particular parts of our past that kind of link up. And, you know, we're kind of basically just exploring how each of us works. And it's really, really pleasurable to do that. And I think that's probably where things like those investigations, like the object records, for example.
Yep.
I mean, during that late period of the 90s, I was really heavily involved in the early kind of particularly Brisbane hip-hop stuff, but some stuff interstate as well, like Fugleman. All of those guys are kind of extended family with the Hydrofunk guys and all that kind of thing. And, you know, I still, you know, very much value what I learned during that period. But I guess for me, in terms of my capacity to create work that I feel is meaningful, useful, offers something that potentially isn't already there, I guess I sort of feel like I've found at least something to aim at. You know, I don't know what wilderness of mirrors means to other people, but for me, it feels like I've been able to reconcile a bunch of questions that I've had for a while, and it kind of feels as if it's got something pushing it. It's hungry, and I like that, and I like the process of creating that.
Yeah, well, that's really fantastic to hear. And yeah, I'm really interested in what you said about collaborations, because there have been a lot of them over the years, and still are, obviously. And it's always nice to sort of see your name pop up, like with the Rational Academy stuff, which I absolutely love, and I know you've been involved with, and, you know, and those guys have been involved with your work and things for a while.
Definitely.
As well.
Ben is still helping me. We just had David Grubbs here the other day, and Ben has the most incredible array of guitars ever, so we were able to borrow a guitar for David Grubbs. So I was very happy about that.
Superb. Cool. So I was going to bring that up, and I'm glad that you've talked a bit about that. So I suppose when you're working with MCs, as you a long time ago you might have been, then there's some sort of lyrical way of expressing things, political things and so on. But I know that even with this new album, you've been a bit driven by the absolutely baleful political world that Australia finds itself in the last while. I know that becoming a dad has also had a big impact on maybe what you want to say and how.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably made me it's awakened a compassion, I think, maybe, that, you know, it was always there, but maybe it was expressed differently. And I think that is the best thing that's happened to me in a very, very long time, well, probably ever. You know, I feel I have a capacity for humanity that I did not have previously. And at the same time, I'm seeing this kind of erosion going on. It's not just here either. You know, it really is it's a question of the West, for want of a, you know, bigger cliche. Sure. Particularly, you know, in the last 2 years, 18 months, basically, it's been a incredibly disappointing political engagement, you know, with each other, with us as constituents, with the basic tenets of what I think makes a decent sense of humanity and community. That was definitely a very, very big part of making this record, and a lot of the frustration I think I felt fueled in some way some of the kind of qualities of the record. And also, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this idea of kind of politics of perception in a way, and that can be read in lots of different ways. But, you know, I think there is a way in which a kind of political sensibility can be suggested, maybe not transferred, but suggested potentially, or prioritized in a way that if it's with field recordings, the way that which you prioritize a certain kind of range of sounds from a kind of limitless field. Or, you know, if in terms of composition, how it is that you present certain kinds of elements. that doesn't necessarily get rooted into anything kind of direct, I think, until you kind of have conversations like this where, you know, you can link it back. And it is, I mean, ultimately it's a personal expression. You know, it's what I'm feeling. Someone else might listen to it and it might be the soundtrack for their rage against something that they see as really distasteful. And I hope in some respects it does occupy both that sense of frustration, but also a sense of relief and release.
Yeah, that's a really nice thing, I think, to, I guess, a nice ambition for a release that obviously is fairly abstract. And I think that's a great place to maybe duck out. But I guess what I'm going to play straight after are the last ish three-ish tracks from Wilderness of Mirrors, which well, you were talking earlier about how the album, if it has if it sort of has much of a structure, it progresses from slightly more abstracted sounds to slightly more recognizable sounds perhaps. But I guess one place where you can express yourself if you want to in instrumental music is the titles. But is there anything to say about Forgiving Noir, Graceless Hunter, and Hapless Gatherer?
Well, definitely there is for Graceless Hunter. I mean, it for me summarizes how it is that we approach feeding ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's this great line where it talks about the idea that, you know, there was a kind of exchange, and I've talked about this a few times. There's a great film called Nanook of the North, and there's this sequence that you can look up on YouTube of these Inuits bringing in a walrus, and there's this exchange, this kind of energy exchange that goes on. The walrus wants to live, its partner wants it to live, but they want to feed their families, and there's this thing that happens. You can see them working for that meal. And I think we are now, you know, we really are graceless hunters. We just have such a disconnected relationship with these things, and you don't necessarily think about the fact that, you know, when I enjoy my bacon for lunch, that was a pig. You know, it was a pig at least for me, I know where my pigs grow up. I know that they live outdoors, and I know how they die. And you know, that's what I want to know now. If I'm doing stuff and I'm in Brisbane, I want to know as much as I can about that, because you are responsible for that guy, or girl dead, you know, that's on your hands. Morrissey was, you know, would be proud, I'm sure.
Morrissey would probably be
he'd be
yelling at you with
God damn it.
Yes,
there was something breaking up there.
Yes. Morrissey would consider you a murderer.
Yeah, but and effectively we are.
Yeah.
Maybe a graceless hunter is a much softer metaphor.
Sure. That's really nice to hear, and we will get to that very soon, but we'll go from Forgiving Noir, and we'll hear this last passage. So congratulations on a beautiful album, Wilderness
Thank
of Mirrors.
You so much,
And congratulations on putting it out on Room 40. And indeed on 15 years next year, is it?
Yeah.
It's amazing. I look forward to celebrations happening of some sort. It seems like it was minutes ago when 10 years happened and there were big compilations and things, but
it's a very you know, days are long and years are short.
That's it, isn't it? Awesome. Well, great to chat.
Likewise.
And we'll hear a bit more of your music now on the show. Look forward to these field recordings, which will be out a bit later this year, I guess.
Yeah, they will.
Mm-hmm. Fabulous. Okay,
thanks,
so this is Lawrence English on FBI. We have been chatting to for the last little while. Enjoy. The absolutely beautiful ending to Lawrence English's new album Wilderness of Mirrors. That was Hapless Gatherer. And before that we had the previous two tracks, Graceless Hunter and Forgiving Noir, and I was talking for quite a long time with Lawrence before that. This is something I referenced in the interview, possibly the last time Lawrence was making beats on his own, at least with his Project Object. He actually had a second album as Object, but this one was from 2003 and it's called Pandemic. We're going to hear the track Horizon. I feel there's a bit of a Scorn influence or something on this. And then I'm going to play one other really beautiful track, more on the sort of drone sound art realm, from his album Colour of Autumn, Colour for Autumn, from 2009 on the 12K label. And we're going to hear a lovely sort of choral piece from Lawrence English from Brisbane. Then we'll move on to some other artists for the rest of tonight's show. You're with Peter Hollow on Utility Fog on FBI. This is Horizon from Lawrence English as Object.